is 55 centimeters high, with a zune, a vessel used in ancient times, on top of the head. The lower part is 60 centimeters in size, with kneeling posture. Similar findings in the past were just 20 centimeters in their heights. The bronze figure was discovered under massive ivory objects. So far, over 500 objects, including ivory, bronze, gold, and jade ware, have been found from six sacrificial pits of the Sanjiangdu ruins. A Chinese man becomes the first blind Asian mountaineer to successfully scale the world's tallest peak, the Mount Everest. Zhang Hong completed the 8,849-meter high Himalayan feat with three high-altitude guides. The 46-year-old climber said he spent much of his trek holding onto his guide's arm. The pair said the most tiresome and risky areas were the so-called death zones, ice walls, and ice falls at around 8,000 meters. The Chinese climber recalled humbly embracing being part of Mother Nature after he completed his arduous journey.
No matter if you're disabled or normal, whether you have lost your eyesight or you have no legs or hands, it doesn't matter. As long as you have a strong mind, you can always complete anything that other people think you can't.
Zhang added that this is only the beginning. He said his next milestone is climbing the highest peaks from the world's continents, known as the Seven Summits. The Chinese mountaineer lost his eyesight at the age of 21. After his success, he became the third visually impaired person to ever step foot on the Everest peak. A Russian company has developed a fully self-driving car that looks like it was taken right out of a sci-fi movie. Flip is the size of a conventional passenger car and has enough space for six people. Its creator says the advanced vehicle is a taxi of the future. Flip has fulfilled the requirements of international automated driving standards. It's powered by electricity, but it can also use other fuels like gas and hydrogen. The owners of this futuristic vehicle do not have to worry about running out of power. That's because its replaceable batteries can be changed in less than 5 minutes once they are out of electricity. A rare baby giraffe is born in a zoo in western France as conservationists try to increase the population of this endangered species. The cute Rothschild giraffe is the second born in a French zoo this year. Caretakers say the cubs will stay with the facility for 1 year before they would be sent to another site to start their own families. The Rothschild giraffes are critically endangered, and conservationists say that only 1,600 of them exist now. The general giraffe populations in the wild have also decreased by around 30% in the last three decades.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Thank you. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The abduction of indigenous children was a project meant to render their worlds unsalvageable, create new realities on the ground, demoralize them out of resistance. This is perhaps why the Israeli regime military targets children. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Benny Bland Ryder. This article is published under the heading, From Boarding Schools to Child Detention, Lives of Children Matter. Stay tuned for the details. Yes, I am thinking of Palestinian children and undocumented children as well, mused then activist Melissa Tesso. They are literally being killed daily by these settler governments. As an essential part of her culture, running helps to process things. And so she did the 2.15 run in memory of 215 indigenous children who were found in a mass grave at Kamloops Residential School in Canada. On May 29, 2021, Al Jazeera reported that the remains of more than 200 indigenous children, some as young as 3, have been found at the site of a former residential school in Western Province of British Columbia. To our knowledge, these missing children are undocumented death. Tekalumpus Toskumpe First Nation Chief Rosanne Casimir explained. They are among the many victims of mental and sexual abuse, neglect, and other forms of violence over a period of 100 years during which church-supported boarding schools operated across Canada. By forcibly taking children from their families, the schools sought to break Indigenous family and cultural ties in order to assimilate children into white Canadian society. According to Muscovis Voices, co-founder of Bear Clan Patrol, Calgary, and chairman of MIM Social Justice Committee, approximately 6,000 Native children died in residential schools from disease, beatings, firing squads, malnutrition, and electrocution, among other forms of torture and neglect. The residential schools took the children from the land. Voices continues, adding, to disconnect people from their culture in order to take the land from children. Moreover, this form of genocide, he says, is ongoing as children are still removed from their ancestral lineages. One of the worst and most powerful things on this earth is the look in a mother's eyes and the pain she experiences when she has that which she loves most in this world taken away from her. Because the violence is ongoing, so is the trauma. Mental scars that are generational in nature, in that they are passed down from parents to children in a never-ending cycle of pain. Nevertheless, what happened to the children at Kamloops Residential School, writes Adel Skander, assistant professor of global communication at Simon Fraser University, is neither unique nor surprising. Like settler colonial projects everywhere, including the Americas and Palestine, its objectives, he continues, were always a combination of land appropriation, resource extraction, and demographic engineering. The abduction of indigenous children, he concludes, was a project meant to render their worlds unsalvageable, create new realities on the ground, demoralize them out of resistance. Given this framework, it makes sense that the Israeli regime's treatment of Palestinian children would be much the same. Indeed, in the past few days, the Zionist regime has launched a massive arrest campaign against Palestinians who participated in recent uprisings against the colonial project. As Abir Kopti notes, Zionist regime police officers, border police, and secret service members are expected to arrest approximately 500 participants in peaceful protests. Among those arrested have been children including Abdul Khaler and Mohammad Bornat, sons of Berlin activist by Ayad Bornat. In an interview with Robert Inlakish, Bornat chronicles the history of Israeli regime aggression that has for years been unleashed on his family. Earlier in May, Zionist forces murdered his nephew Islam, a 16-year-old boy who was participating in the protest. Since then, they have repeatedly invaded his house along with other homes, wreaking havoc and arresting the children of other families. After they took Abdul Khaler and Muhammad, my wife and my daughter don't sleep. The tears haven't left my wife's eye, said Iyad. My youngest son, Muhyiddin, he continues, Abdul Khaler and Muhammad are now in Al-Mukbiya prison, a detention facility in West Al-Quds that, in Lakish says, has a reputation for using high-level forms of torture during interrogations. Indeed, Bernard reports that his lawyer, who communicated with Abdul Khaler via computer screen, attests that the boy says he is being placed in what is known as a ghost chair for more than 15 hours a day in order to extract information that he does not have. According to Bernard, the ghost chair is small so that the hands and feet can be tightly tied to inflict a maximum amount of pain. These two boys are among the many children now in the Zionist regime jails. Palestinian journalist Zaina Halwani, recently arrested while covering protests in Sheikh Jarrah, documented her experience listening to Palestinian children screaming for their mothers during few nights that she spent in prison. In 1948, Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion warned, "We must do everything to ensure Palestinians never do return." Indeed, he hoped that the old will die and the young will forget, ensuring that they would not return to their homes. This is perhaps why the Zionist regime military targets children like Abdul Khaler and Muhammad. They want to begin breaking the resistance of the Palestinians when they are young in hopes that they will leave their land. It was also the rationale behind forcibly taking indigenous children away from their family in order to send them to the now infamous boarding schools, thereby severing their connection with the land. Fortunately, for the indigenous in the Americas and in Palestine, that strategy has failed. This resistance demonstrates the spiritual relationship between indigenous peoples and their land, a connection that native people believe the pipeline will sever. Given both these examples, it is clear that colonial efforts to ethnically clear the land has completely failed. As Melissa Tassot concludes, it shouldn't take the findings of our people's remains to validate this horrible legacy of colonial regimes. Respect our humanity by respecting the results, the truth in history, and by supporting our struggle for liberation. Stop treating us the same way our kids got mistreated in residential and boarding. Stand up for indigenous rights always. The same should be said for Palestinian children too.
It was a march that never happened on the occupied territories. Israeli settlers were supposed to hold a flags march in the occupied Jerusalem Al-Quds, but it looked like as soon as the flags march was announced, it was canceled. The reason? Hamas threatened to activate its missiles. All this was preceded by warnings and threats issued by the Palestinian resistance, where the head of Hamas in the Gaza Strip, Yahya Sinwar, stressed that if the confrontation with Israel erupts again, the shape of the Middle East will be different from what it is now. Sinwar stressed that the resistance is able to achieve deterrence and was able to make possible the accumulated force. Based on the order of how the announcement was then rescinded, after Hamas made this threat, it appears that Israel has surrendered to Hamas. This conclusion is also based on Israel's loss to the Palestinian resistance faction's victory over the Israeli regime recently in the 11-day war. Israel had to surrender, stop the war, and then go to Egypt to broker a permanent ceasefire. The U.S. administration also weighed in and called on Israel not to take steps that would ignite the situation in Jerusalem.
To say that there's a permanent ceasefire, I think, is dreaming. There has never been a permanent ceasefire, and there won't be one until the siege ends and the occupation ends and there's justice for Palestinians. So again, I think that that is really hyperbole. I do believe that the U.S. pressured Israel and said, you have done enough and time to stop. But again, we've seen this pattern over and over and over again, and so I am not particularly optimistic. I think there was also pressure because of the issue around the different parties trying to coalesce around toppling Netanyahu, and that fed into the outcome.
The situation in occupied East Jerusalem Al-Quds remains tense, especially in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. From forced evictions to the detainment of activists, the occupied neighborhood remains a tinderbox. Most recently, Israel detained a prominent female Palestinian activist in a raid on her home in Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of the occupied East Jerusalem Al-Quds. Mona Al-Kord leads the Safe Jarrah campaign. It's a campaign which has been trying to mobilize actions against Israel's plan to displace dozens of Palestinian families from their homes in Sheikh Jarrah. She was released days later, but the evictions still continue, and hence the violent clashes between Palestinian resistance and Israeli occupying forces. Israel has been under heavy pressure from the resistance groups in Gaza and Lebanon. Days ago, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, the Secretary General of Hezbollah Resistance Movement, warned Israel that any aggression on holy sites in the occupied Jerusalem Al-Quds would lead to regional war and destruction of the Tel Aviv regime.
Well, I do think that attacks on Al-Aqsa Mosque are incredibly dangerous and would ignite a tremendous amount of rage amongst Muslims all over the world and potentially a regional war. And I think it is very important that Israel not do this, and it would be catastrophic. Again, I cannot emphasize enough that Israel is a massive military power with nuclear weapons, with U.S. backing, and there have been many instances of the past where Arab nations have threatened to, quote, destroy Israel, and they have been quite unsuccessful. So I think we have to be very realistic in terms of the level of military might that Israel has, given the history of the region.
Furthermore, a report has revealed that both Hamas and Hezbollah chiefs had discussed a plan for the liberation of all Palestine. This was discussed last year and prior to the 11-day war. The recent blow dealt to Israel during the 11-day Gaza war was part of the liberation plan. The Palestinian resistance adopted tactics used by Hezbollah during 2006 war by setting up mock rocket launch sites to deceive the Israeli Air Force. Yemen's Ansarullah also communicated with Hamas and requested coordinates for the site it wanted to target with missiles and drones, but Hamas told the popular movement not to intervene as long as the Israeli army had not crossed the red lines. Now, with a new cabinet being formed in Israel, this should serve as warning to the incoming administration to make sure the rights of Palestinians will not be violated and Palestinians will be allowed to pray in Jerusalem at Quds. Palestinians, however, are not holding their breath. They are rest assured, however, that resistance groups like Hamas and Hezbollah have their backs.
Tensions are growing between the West and Belarus after Minsk scrambled a fighter jet to divert the flight path of a Lithuania-bound Ryanair passenger plane and forced it to land late last month. Minutes after the landing, Belarusian authorities arrested 26-year-old opposition blogger Roman Protasevich and his fiancée who were on the plane. The move infuriated the European Union and the United States.
And Belarus used its control over its airspace in order to perpetrate a state hijacking. Therefore, the safety and security of flights through Belarus airspace can no longer be trusted.
During a summit in Brussels, EU leaders urged carriers based on the bloc to avoid flying over Belarus. In addition, they have agreed to ban Belarusian airlines from using the bloc's airspace and airports. The 27-nation bloc has slammed more economic sanctions on Belarus. The EU says it has indefinitely frozen a 3 billion euro investment package for the country. Minsk's move has been slammed by some EU leaders as, quote, state piracy.
Essentially, Belarus is very highly aligned to Russia, and that is the choice that they made. Well, this doesn't sit well with U.S. imperialist efforts who want to see all, essentially all countries in the world allied to them and subservient to them. Now, this is part of a larger U.S. strategy to try to encircle Russia within Europe. As we know that the current Ukrainian crisis is going on right now, where NATO-aligned forces are going to be fighting Russian-aligned and full-on Russian forces probably sometime in mid-June when the permafrost finally melts and it's more advantageous to move large vehicles across Ukraine. Belarus is allied to Russia.
Belarus says it requested the emergency landing due to a suspected bomb threat on the plane. The airliner then left Minsk for its destination in Lithuania shortly after. In a video broadcast by Belarusian state media, Roman Protasevich said he was in good health and cooperating with the country's officials.
Hello, my name is Roman Protasevich. I was detained yesterday at the Minsk National Airport. I'm now in the Minsk Detention Center number 1. I can say that I don't have any health issues, including heart or any other organs disease. Police officers treat me properly and according to the law. Also, I now continue to cooperate with the investigation and give a confession on organizing mass protests in Minsk.
The opposition was quick to reject the statement, arguing that Protasevich was confessing under duress. But Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko has denied any wrongdoing, accusing the West of seeking to provoke unrest in his country. In a meeting with his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin, Lukashenko said the West is trying to, quote, rock the boat to cause a new round of protests against his government. He was referring to the outbreak of protests after the 2020 presidential election, when his opponent and Western countries accused his government of voter fraud. President Putin has also warned the West against meddling in Belarus's internal affairs. He also dismissed speculations that Russia participated in diverting the airliner.
This isn't simply someone being targeted by a country for, you know, whatever reason. There is a very clear process here. A person is wanted for a crime, and if they pass through the country, then they are going to be stopped. I mean, this is not even comparable to, say, Chinese Huawei CFO who was stopped in Canada for a crime that doesn't even exist there.
The recent incident wasn't the first that led to rising tensions between the West and Belarus, which is in a union state with Russia, and will certainly not be the last.
Yemen, the world's worst humanitarian crisis, according to the United Nations. The UN says 24 million Yemenis are in dire need of humanitarian aid, including 10 million suffering from famine. Yemen has struggled with mass outbreaks of infectious diseases, and poverty has surged to affect as much as 78% of the population since 2015, when Saudi Arabia and its regional states launched a devastating war on Yemen. The U.S. and several other Western countries have participated in the war by providing arms and logistic support for the Saudi coalition. The United Nations says the Saudi-led war on Yemen has caused an estimated 233,000 deaths, including 131,000 from an indirect cause such as lack of food, health services, and infrastructure. Meanwhile, the World Food Program has estimated that around 400,000 Yemeni children under 5 are likely to die of starvation in 2021. That is nearly one child every 80 seconds. While the results of the US-sponsored Saudi aggression on Yemen speak for themselves, Washington is trying to push a narrative that the Ansarullah movement is mostly to blame for the ongoing problems in Yemen, not Saudi Arabia. After returning from a trip to some Arab states of the Persian Gulf, including Saudi Arabia, the U.S. Special Envoy for Yemen, Tim Lenderking, accused Ansarullah of refusing a proposed ceasefire. However, the movement has consistently participated in peace talks with the Saudis and allies of former Saudi-backed government. The main reason for the failure of previous peace talks was that the Saudis refused any deal involving power sharing or a fresh election. That's why the Saudi-enforced war on Yemen was aimed at bringing the Saudi-backed former regime to power and crush the popular Ansarullah movement. Despite years of ongoing aggression against Yemenis and spending billions of dollars, Saudi Arabia and its supporter, the U.S., have been unable to defeat the popular Ansarullah movement, and the recent willingness to negotiate a truce proves their weakened position.
The U.S. Narrative should be ignored because it has nothing to do with reality or truth. The people of Yemen continue to suffer because of U.S. actions, because of U.S. sending weapons to Saudi Arabia. The Ansarullah movement has nothing to do with, they're defending the people of Yemen, certainly, but they are not the reason for the war. It is Saudi aggression financed by the United States that is the reason for the war.
The U.S. Special Envoy for Yemen has accused Yemen's Ansarullah movement of not trying to reach an urgently needed ceasefire in the war-torn country. That's why the Biden administration has refused to pressure Saudi Arabia into lifting the blockade on Yemen, which is a key Ansarullah condition for a ceasefire. The Saudi-enforced blockade has caused a lack of food and medicine. Meanwhile, the Ansarullah movement, as well as activists and international aid groups, have been calling on Riyadh to separate the blockade from the negotiations and not use the suffering of ordinary Yemenis as a bargaining chip. Moreover, the U.S. administration of Joe Biden has tried to show itself as a so-called impartial mediator, trying to resolve the ongoing conflict in Yemen. For instance, in February, the Biden administration announced that the United States was ending its support for the Saudi-led bombing campaign in Yemen. But Biden said Washington will continue to help Saudi Arabia defend its sovereignty and land. Washington's so-called defensive support for Riyadh includes providing maintenance services to Saudi Arabia's warplanes that are bombing Yemen.
When Joe Biden became president, he made some statements about no longer financing the war in Yemen, no longer supporting it, but he continues to send arms to Saudi Arabia. Now, he calls these defensive, but that's not what they're used for. As long as the profits continue to flow to the United States, the government doesn't care who's dying. The U.S. government doesn't care whose blood is flowing, whose children are suffering and dying, as long as the profits continue to accrue to the United States. So that's what's happening now. Biden can say that he doesn't support the war anymore, but continues to send armaments that are being used in that war. So it's complete hypocrisy, which is typical for the United States. It's an ongoing, unfortunate tradition with the United States, and it's not going to stop under Joe Biden.
Washington previously announced it is halting its support for offensive Saudi-led operations in Yemen, but the U.S. is still helping Saudis in the Yemen war. Furthermore, Washington has refrained from holding Saudi Arabia accountable for the current crisis in Yemen, as it has refused to pressure Riyadh into lifting the blockade on Yemen or to end its aggression. And that is a clear sign of the U.S. shielding of Saudi Arabia and Washington's contribution to this war.
Iran's Foreign Minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, has strongly condemned a United Nations decision to strip Tehran of its voting rights in the UN General Assembly.
This decision is fundamentally flawed, entirely unacceptable, and completely unjustified, as Iran's inability to fulfill its financial obligation toward the United Nations is indirectly caused by unlawful unilateral sanctions imposed by the United States to punish those who comply with a Security Council resolution.
In a letter to the UN chief, Zarif said, "Taking away Iran's voting privileges violates the UN Charter and the spirit of sovereign equality of member states." He said Iran failed to pay its dues because of extreme conditions imposed by the U.S. on its banking relations. Zarif stressed that Washington's, quote, "economic terrorism has faced Iran with difficulty buying food and medicine, let alone paying its UN fees." He accused the United States of attempting to mass-starve Iranian people and condemned the United Nations' inaction on anti-Iran sanctions. Zarif noted that nevertheless, his country remains committed to settling its arrears.
The UN should totally understand Iran's position. It's been sanctioned by the worst international sanctions ever imposed on a nation, arguably, in the modern era. And yet the United Nations has religiously decided to ignore the realities and the circumstances of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Of course, it goes deeper than this. The United Nations relies on the US of A for its funds. The majority of the funds that keep the United Nations going come from America. And of course, they're based primarily in the US as well. It's a misnomer to imagine that the UN is independent.
In the meantime, Iran maintains that it has always paid its dues to the international body, despite the sanctions. The spokesman for Iran's foreign ministry says the country has regularly paid its UN membership contributions during the past years, despite unilateral sanctions imposed by the United States on Tehran, which have made financial transactions difficult for the Islamic Republic. Saeed Khatibzadeh said Tehran has been in talks with the UN Treasury to settle the debt. He also urged the world body to introduce a self-transaction channel after the U.S. blocked the previous channels used by the Islamic Republic to transfer money. The foreign ministry spokesman said Iran has proposed using its frozen assets in South Korea to pay off the arrears. He said the United Nations Secretariat is completely aware of the details of the issue, which he said was not Iran's fault whatsoever. According to a statement by the UN General Assembly, as of 21st of May 2021, five member states are subject to provisions of Article 19 of the Charter, including Iran and the Central African Republic.
Nothing is being left unturned, no stone is being left unturned to make Iran bow. Islamic Republic of Iran is arguably one of the last nations still not to be part of the Bank of International Settlements, if you like, subjugated sovereign powers. There's a running theme. Those who control those institutions and have those levers of power don't want Iran to succeed in any way, because the Islamic Republic of Iran stands for a set of principles, primarily Islamic principles, but humanitarian principles and real principles of justice and fairness.
This is while the same article allows an exception for member states that can demonstrate the conditions beyond their control contributed to their inability to make payments. But the world body has so far rejected Iran's argument that the impacts of the sanctions prevented Tehran from paying off its arrears.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. Top federal intelligence agencies failed to adequately warn law enforcement officials before the 6th of January riot that pro-Trump extremists were threatening violence, including plans to storm the Capitol, infiltrate its tunnel system, and bring guns, according to a new report by two Senate committees that outlines large-scale failures that contributed to the deadly assault. The 127-page joint report is the most comprehensive and detailed account to date on the intelligence, communications, and policing failures around the Capitol riot. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Luke Broadwater and Nicholas Fandos. The piece is titled Senate Report Details Security Failures in 6th of January Capitol Riot. Top federal intelligence agencies failed to adequately warn law enforcement officials before the January 6th riot that pro-Trump extremists were threatening violence, including plans to storm the Capitol, infiltrate its tunnel system and bring guns, according to a new report by two Senate committees that outlines large-scale failures that contributed to the deadly assault. The 127-page joint report is the most comprehensive and detailed account to date on the intelligence, communications, and policing failures around the Capitol riot. An FBI memo on 5th of January warning of people traveling to Washington for war at the Capitol never made its way to top law enforcement officials. The Capitol Police failed to widely circulate information its own intelligence unit had collected as early as mid-December about the threat of violence on 6th of January, including a report that said right-wing extremist groups and supporters of President Donald J. Trump had been posting online and in far-right chat groups about gathering at the Capitol, armed with weapons, to pressure lawmakers to overturn his election loss. If they don't show up, we enter the Capitol as the Third Continental Congress and certify the Trump electors, one post said. Bring guns, it's now or never, said another. The first congressional report on the Capitol riot is the most comprehensive and detailed account to date of the dozens of intelligence failures, miscommunications, and security lapses that led to what the bipartisan team of senators that assembled it concluded was an unprecedented attack on American democracy and the most significant assault on the Capitol in more than 200 years. The failure to adequately assess the threat of violence on that day contributed significantly to the breach of the Capitol, said Senator Gary Peters, Democrat of Michigan and the chairman of the Homeland Security and Government Affairs Committee. Senator Gary Peters added, "The attack was, quite frankly, planned in plain sight." The 127-page joint report, a product of more than 3 months of hearings and interviews and reviews of thousands of pages of documents, presents a damning portrait of the preparations and response at multiple levels. Law enforcement officials did not take seriously threats of violence, it found, and a dysfunctional police force at the Capitol lacked the capacity to respond effectively when those threats materialized. "The failures are obvious," said Senator Amy Klobuchar, Democrat of Minnesota and the chairwoman of the Rules and Administration Committee. "To me, it was all summed up by one of the officers who was heard on the radio that day asking a tragically simple question, 'Does anybody have a plan?' Sadly, no one did." In response to the report, the Capitol Police said in a statement that its leaders agreed that the force needed improvement, including changing the way it collects and shares intelligence. But it insisted that law enforcement officials had no way of knowing that a pro-Trump rally would turn into a mass assault. Before 6th of January, the Capitol Police leadership knew Congress and the Capitol grounds were to be focus of a large demonstration, attracting various groups, including some encouraging violence, the statement said. But it added, neither the USCP nor the FBI, US Secret Service, Metropolitan Police, or other law enforcement partners knew thousands of rioters were planning to attack the US Capitol. The known intelligence simply didn't support that conclusion. Yet the Senate investigation found that the department had ample warnings weeks earlier that violent extremists, including members of Proud Boys and Oath Keepers, were planning such action and failed to share it widely or incorporate the warnings into its operational plan for 6th of January. Several comments promote confronting members of Congress and carrying firearms during the protest, a Capitol Police intelligence analyst wrote in a threat report on 21st of December, which included a map of the Capitol complex that had been posted on the pro-Trump blog TheDonald.win. Among the posts cited in the threat report, "Bring guns, it's now or never, and we can't give them a choice. Overwhelming armed numbers is our only chance." The Senate's investigative report is the product of a collaboration among Senator Gary Peters, Senator Amy Klobuchar, and the top Republicans on the two committees they lead, Senator Rob Portman of Ohio on the Homeland Security Committee, and Senator Roy Blunt of Missouri on the Rules Committee. It is limited by its bipartisan nature, given that Republicans have refused to ask questions about the riot that could turn up unflattering information about Donald Trump or members of their party, as they try to put his political implications behind them before the 2022 midterm elections. Though the report states flatly that Mr. Trump continued to assert that the election was stolen from him and promoted the Stop the Steal gathering in Washington before the riot, it does not chart his actions or motivations, state that his election claims were false, or explore the implications of a president and elected leaders in his party stoking outrage among millions of supporters. The inquiry does not describe the events of 6th of January as an insurrection, a term many Republicans had joined Democrats in embracing immediately after the attack. Aides involved in its drafting said they had refrained from trying to summarize or contextualize Donald Trump's false claims just before the riot took place. They opted instead to include the full text of his speech in an appendix. Many of the findings in the report were culled from public testimony from committee hearings, though five people sat for detailed interviews with the committee. Christopher C. Miller, who was the acting defense secretary at the time, Ryan D. McCarthy, the Army secretary, General James C. McConville, the Army chief of staff, Yogananda D. Pittman, the acting chief of the Capitol Police, and J. Brett Blanton, the architect of the Capitol. The committee staff solicited more than 50 statements from Capitol police officers that painted a vivid portrayal of the rioters, some of whom gave Nazi salutes and held racist slurs at them. One officer described being crushed by the mob. Another told the committee that she still suffered from chemical burns she experienced that day. About 140 law enforcement officers reported injuries from the riot. The bipartisan report also tied 7 fatalities to the assault, including 5 protesters who died and 3 police officers who died in its aftermath, 2 from suicide. The document lays out profound problems with the Special Capitol Police Unit that handles civil disturbances, only a fraction of which was adequately trained to respond to a riot and which was poorly equipped. On 6th of January, its officers were not authorized to wear protective gear at the beginning of their shifts or to use their most powerful non-lethal weapons, such as grenade launchers and sting ball grenades, to push back crowds because they lacked the training to do so. Let's be honest, Capitol Police were put in an impossible situation, Senator Rob Portman said. Without adequate intelligence, training, and equipment, they did not have the tools to protect the Capitol. The committees recommended 20 improvements, like beefing up police training and equipment and forming a single intelligence bureau in the Capitol Police to better share information. Their suggestions followed from Lieutenant General Russell Honore, a retired Army officer whom Speaker Nancy Pelosi of California chose to lead a House task force that recommended the hiring of more than 800 Capitol Police officers. The construction of mobile fencing around the complex and changes to Capitol Police Board procedures to allow the agency's chief to quickly summon the National Guard in an emergency. Senator Roy Blunt of Missouri said he and Senator Amy Klobuchar would soon introduce legislation to grant the Capitol Police Chief power to unilaterally summon the National Guard in emergencies. He said they were also likely to assemble a spending bill to increase funding for the department and carry out other changes. There was much information the panel was unable to learn. The senators secured only limited cooperation from key agencies, including the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security, the Justice Department, and the House Sergeant at Arms. Other agencies failed to meet deadlines to hand over documents. The findings and their limitations are likely to fuel renewed calls for an independent commission, like the one created after the 11th of September 2001 attacks, populated by experts and armed with subpoena power to investigate what happened on that day and why. Senate Republicans blocked the creation of such a body late last month, arguing in part that it would duplicate the work already underway by the Senate committees and prosecutors at the Justice Department.
The World with Reporters.
The seven presidential candidates in Iran once again assembled at the headquarters of the Iranian National Television, the IRIB, to face off in the second out of three live debates, which was themed with social and political issues. After a contentious first debate, candidates used respectful tones this time and tried to use their allocated time to its last second to answer the questions and outline their plans before the mute button is pressed.
If I am elected president, I will make changes to the circulars that allow astronomical salaries for certain managers. This way, we can help promote justice.
My government will support the most vulnerable strata of society. I believe if we want to address our economic issues, we need to begin by improving the livelihood of less privileged groups of society.
If we use the culture of show-off in our politics, we cannot solve the problems. We need to act, and the public must see the results.
Currently, there are some 7 million heads of household in our country that depend on charities to make ends meet. We need to set up a fund that ensures a sustainable income for these people.
The three-hour debate was not without controversy. Some of the candidates said the coronavirus pandemic should have been over by now. But President Hassan Rouhani's, quote, sluggish response to COVID-19 has caused the pandemic to claim more lives.
The government must have acted swiftly with regard to vaccine imports. There was a chance to import 18 million doses of vaccines, but the government missed that chance, and it came at the cost of people's lives.
The debate was focused on social issues, but some of the candidates steered the topic toward economic themes. When asked about their policies to promote social equality.
Social problems emanate from economic problems. I'm an economist, and I know how to cure the ailing Iranian economy. If these problems are solved, the social challenges will also be addressed appropriately.
To fight corruption, we need to fight unfair wealth distribution. We need to pay equal attention to the less privileged stratum of society.
To maintain impartiality, the national television has arranged every step of the debate based on a lottery system, from the order of the candidates' entrance to the IRIB to the questions posed to them, and even their seats are determined randomly. Candidates will face off for the last time on June 12th in the third and final debate. After a pugnacious first debate, candidates seem to be more restrained in the second debate, trying to make the best of their allocated time to woo more voters. Yet, it's still soon to judge about who stands a better chance to be the next Iranian president, since the race is still on. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
To find a solution to the years-long war on Yemen, an Omani delegation has visited Sana'a and held talks with the leader of Yemen's Ansarullah movement, Abdul Malik al-Houthi, and the head of Yemen's Supreme Political Council. During the talks, Houthi hailed Oman for its efforts and stance beside Yemenis since the beginning of the Saudi war on Yemen.
The Omani delegation is exerting efforts, but its success is possible when the Saudi-led coalition admits it's failed in Yemen. However, it seems Saudi Arabia is still trying to impose pressure on Sana'a by tightening the siege to gain what it has failed to achieve in the war. We appreciate what our Omani brothers are doing and hope that they will succeed in ending the suffering of our people.
Observers say there's good progress in the humanitarian situation and Sana'a Airport might be reopened soon, as well as Hodeidah Port, which means that the fuel ships will be allowed to enter the country. They believe that the success of Oman's delegation will relieve the suffering of millions of Yemenis.
There's a keenness by Sana'a's leadership for the Saudi-led coalition to start taking steps to prove its good intentions to end the aggression. The first of these steps is to complete the humanitarian agreement, open Sana'a's airport and Hodeidah port, and allow the entry of oil ships. After that, other issues will be agreed upon, and this will build trust between the two parties. And the Omani delegation seems to be succeeding in that.
To meet the political leadership and discuss the possible ways to lift the siege imposed on Yemenis by Saudi Arabia. Since the beginning of 2015, the Saudi war has killed thousands of civilians, including women and children, and pushed the war-torn country to the brink of famine.
Yemenis believe that the Omani delegation is finally succeeding in removing all impediments to their access to food and fuel. They say lifting the blockade is the first real step toward a nationwide ceasefire and the end of the brutal war on their country. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Since the turmoil of Brexit, the UK's Conservative government has splurged billions of dollars on expensive military projects, with plans to spend hundreds of billions more to project Britain's military might internationally. But while it's loosened the purse strings of military spending, the British government has tightened them on the country's underfunded public health system and on foreign aid, where it used to lead the way. The $5.5 billion cut will mean less relief for war-torn Yemen, the world's worst humanitarian disaster. The UN Secretary General has called the move a death sentence. The cuts also affect aid to the UN Children's Agency, UNICEF, and other life-saving projects in countries such as Syria, Ethiopia, and Afghanistan. Hundreds of charities, academics, and business leaders have signed a letter warning the government the cuts cast a shadow over the nation's role at the G7 and risk undermining its credibility on the world stage.
The amount of weapons that we are selling to be dropped on the head of the Yemenis on one side, and on the other side denying them any sort of support or cutting down those support, it really is outrageous, unacceptable.
The British government says its decision to slash foreign aid was a response to the economic shock brought on by the pandemic, meaning perhaps that once the health crisis blows over, foreign aid will go back to previous levels.
Despite the pandemic, government aid designed to promote the economic development and welfare of developing countries rose to an all-time high last year, with the largest contributions coming from the U.S., followed by Germany. Britain took third place.
There is a fraction within the sort of extreme right who always wanted to cut our contribution to these countries, and they never believed in giving a helping hand. And I think this is the excuse. Right now, it's an excuse to actually give in to those section of the Conservative Party.
Prime Minister Boris Johnson is facing a rebellion at home from MPs, including his predecessor, Theresa May, pushing the government to reconsider. Theirs and a growing number of other voices are urging Britain to be the world leader it claims to be. Saeed Pourriza, London.